On the Empire Podcast this week, we're joined by human animals, not sadly Jellicle cats. Don't get your hopes up. Yes, Alia Shawcat and Holiday Granger, stars of Animals.
I told Holiday this, but my mom always used to think that we should work together. She was like, you and this actress Holiday Granger, I think, would be wonderful together. And I was like, all right, I'll try and make it happen.
Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that thinks British politics is much like Hollywood. Both, of course, are ruled by a massive Johnson. Only all things considered, theirs is better than ours.
Long live the Rock.
Prime Minister the Rock. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? That'd be all right.
I feel like he'd have to fight Jason Statham for it, which is a film that I would watch.
I'm also happy with Prime Minister Jason Statham, Prime Minister Idris Elba, Prime Minister anyone but the person who's currently Prime Minister. But hey, that's not get political.
Hey.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. I'm joined this week by an esteemed cabinet of colleagues of such lethal cunning. lethal cunning.
Have you been working on that?
No, that was quite good, wasn't it?
It was good. It was good. Let's add that to the official list.
It was him and Jim Broadbent. Yeah, all right.
Bit of both.
First up is the Minister for banging on relentlessly about the Pilot TV podcast.
Hi.
James Dyer. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
How do you feel about the news this week that the London Podcast Festival has added Mark Kermode's podcast at the exact same time as the Pilot TV podcast?
Oh, fight, 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 fight.
I mean,
enter Beast Kermode.
Yeah.
You are going to be playing to four people and a dog.
That's a bit of counter-programming, isn't it? Motherfuckers.
You should team up. You should team up.
Yeah.
Two very different podcasts.
No, but see...
And his is listenable.
I know the way the King's Place is formatted, and it means we'll be sharing a green room, which will give me the opportunity to brutally murder him before he goes on stage, thereby co-opting his audience. So it all plays into my master plan.
Wow.
All right. Producer Jane works closely with the Good Doctor on his BBC... Is it BBC 4 or BBC 2 shows?
Oh.
BBC 4. Yeah, those documentaries that he did about the history of cinema and whatnot. What are they called? I can't remember.
Secrets of Cinema.
That's it. Secrets of Cinema. I'd forgotten. Secrets of Cinema.
Not to be confused with Secrets of Cinema, which is very different.
Producer Jane may tip off the Good Doctor about your plans to murderalize him. I'm just saying. So, and also...
But nothing can stop James.
Nothing can stop James.
I am like Thanos, inevitable.
And this
inevitable.
Might be admissible as evidence.
You think?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh. Also, you may have a few years on him, but he's a big unit, is Mark. So I think he could take you down.
You think I shouldn't have shown my hand?
I don't think you should have shown your hand.
Was that a tactical error?
I think he'll flatten you with a double bass.
Shit.
you'll be in big trouble. All right. Okay. Moving on then, of course, to our Minister for Winchester Nipples. It is...
Good Lord.
Supernatural and Hamilton geek, Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Hey,
yes.
Helen. Hey. I saw Hamilton again this week, third time.
That's cool. I'm seeing it for the third time in September.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, but of course, my first time was with the original Broadway cast. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that, but it was. So I feel like I get bonus points. Your eyes have turned bright green. That's amazing.
You've made an Emmy on this day.
How was the new cast?
Aaron Burr to your Hamilton. How was the new one?
How was the new cast?
That's a passive aggressive question. How was the new cast?
I'm going to be seeing them soon. I'm looking forward to it.
Are they all new? I mean, because I wasn't sure whether the guy playing Hamilton was an understudy or whether the new guy is still there. But it was a Monday night, so maybe he had Monday night off. It was mostly new, but there was a couple of people had held over from the previous production I saw. Very good.
Excellent.
Very, very good. I have to say, and I don't know his name, so if anyone does know his name, then do write in and let me know because I didn't pick up a program. But the guy playing Burr was the best Burr I've seen thus far.
Ooh,
really
exciting.
Good.
Ooh.
Played him with a nice, sardonic, slightly theatrical edge, which I really, really liked. And you can see gradually their performances beginning to move away from the template that is laid down by other people.
Well, that's exciting. I think that's what they need to do to keep it fresh. So
I think
That's wonderful.
Absolutely. Good King George as well.
Oh, yay.
And we're finally joined, of course, by the Minister for just being really darn nice.
Hi, everyone.
It's Ben Travis. How
Hello.
Are you?
Hello. I'm good. In fact, we'll be talking more about Aaron Burr's later in the podcast, because OG Burr is popping up in significant trailer this week.
Hurrah!
Is he?
Yes, he
is. Yeah, Leslie Odom Jr.
Mm. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting. I'm very excited about that. Okay, that'll be in the news section of the show later on. First up, though, it is time for a question. And this question seems rather apt after this week, and it comes from @AdamG_Stark, @Adam_G_Stark on Twitter. And he asks, all this sun which has me hiding in a darkened room with a fan on made me wonder, What are the best scenes slash films that evoke oppressive heat? And he says, immediate thoughts are Rear Window, the Sicilian scenes in The Godfather, and The Graduate. Well, those were my three choices, so I'm going to bow out directly from this one.
Yeah, I mean, Sunshine feels a bit first base, but Sunshine. But also, and I tweeted GIFs from this week, the scene from Knowing, you know, when they look out the window and the world is on fire and the flaming moose comes prancing out of the forest and then, you know, collapses. You know,
what with being dead.
What with being on fire, yeah.
Knowing, and yeah.
It felt a lot like that.
I think about
Alex
Knowing
Broyer
a lot.
Knew what he was talking about.
Me and Roger Ebert, me and Rod are pretty much the only defenders of that film.
And me.
And you?
Yeah. I didn't hate it.
You like Knowing? Yeah. You didn't hate it? Yeah. Ben, where do you stand in Knowing?
I've not seen Knowing, but maybe that's my weekend
plan.
Ben
wasn't born when Knowing came out. This is absolutely fine.
It was, what, 2009
Pretty
or
much,
so?
Yeah.
Ben sounds is about unknowing right. about Knowing. If you don't know Knowing, then get to know Knowing, because Knowing is a utterly gonzo, batshit crazy stealth sci-fi film. It starts out as one thing and then turns into something completely different. And James is referring to dream sequences in which Nick Cage's character sees the world on fire with moose on fire running through a forest landscape. Also on fire, but also it felt weirdly prescient, like a bit of a documentary.
It did.
After this week, where did you see, like, you know, just to quickly go off the beaten path, not that we ever do that before, but you see, like, the weirdly celebratory tweets from people and weirdly celebratory headlines.
Come on, guys, we've nearly beaten the record. Let's see if we can get it up to 30. It's like, first of all, what exactly are you going to do to try and raise the temperature? Like, everyone go outside and hold up a lighter. Like, what is this? And also, this is not a good thing. It's the end of the world.
Burn. Burn.
Spray those fly sprays into the air. Quickly do it. Quick.
As much emissions as you can.
It's disastrous.
It was BBC Weather as well. You think they'd be a little bit more responsible.
Today's the day. We're going to do it today. It's like, what are you doing? We're all going to die. Oh, fun.
Anyway. Yay. So I was thinking of Do the Right Thing, which is getting a re-release this summer for its 30th birthday.
Next week, Helen.
Next week, yeah.
Yeah, that was absolutely on my list as well. And fun facts about that film, it was originally called Heat Wave.
That makes sense.
And the genesis for the movie was Spike Lee had read a report that said that once the temperature hits 90 degrees and above, this is Fahrenheit, by the way, not Celsius. If it hits 90 degrees Celsius and above, we're
in trouble.
Bigger problems.
Yeah. Mm. So he noticed that once the temperature goes above 90 degrees Celsius, scientists had noticed this, that people have shorter fuses, they're quicker to anger, and he thought that would be a lovely basis for Do the Right Thing. But also, Ernest Dickerson, the cinematographer, managed to evoke this real feeling of heat.
Well, he literally...
He would literally...
Yep.
Yeah.
He put gas fires in front of the camera, so basically you get the waves of heat coming up and distorting the image.
Very clever.
And of course, they painted whole areas of Bed-Stuy red, orange, yellow, just heat colours to kind of make it all pop on screen. It's an incredible film. If you haven't seen Do the Right Thing, go see it next week. We'll be talking about it, I'm sure, then.
We will.
But yeah, it also does give you that sweaty... hot feeling the whole time.
And it is about that, isn't it? It's about it's about that feeling of oppressive, cloying heat from which you cannot escape. And I'm going to suggest films that are shot in conditions like that, that helps an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Predator, for example, was shot in the jungle in Mexico, Jimbo.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And they were experiencing proper sweaty conditions, sweaty bum cracks, the whole kit and caboodle. And the sweat dripping down Schwarzenegger's face and perhaps his bum crack as well. We never see it in the movie.
Mm. Thanks for clarifying.
Real sweat.
I've been banned
crack.
From quoting Predator in the office this week, because I find whenever that I end up quoting Anna from Predator, the only in the hottest years they come thing.
And this year,
it grows hot. it's been driving Nick insane.
I mean, it does seem like the Predator would be here.
The demon.
If he was coming.
That makes trophies of men.
Please don't do a Spanish accent. for the love of God. But yes, it does feel like a Predator sort of year. It also feels like a very, very bad time to be involved in a court case, because if To Kill a Mockingbird and 12 Angry Men have taught me anything, it's that, again, tempers will flare up in extremely hot conditions involving trials.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So lots of close-ups of people, very in-your-face cameras, sometimes maybe at a slightly canted angle, so you can really get that sweat, that sense of paranoia and oppression that you get in a hot room. A room much like this one, for example. And we're all very, very friendly right now, but at 12 o'clock and when we finish recording this,
maybe
we'll
a different story.
Well, because
fuck you, Helen.
We have
fuck
to turn the air conditioning off to record the podcast, or you can hear
it we do.
On the podcast.
Yeah.
So it's already quite tropical.
Well done, engineering people.
Three angry men plus Helen.
Ben.
I'm trying to think of films that have that really evocative heat. The thing that's popped to mind, I don't think it's the most iconic, but The Florida Project really got that sense of when you're a kid and you're just like out and about in the summer holidays and you can't get away from the heat when they're hanging around by the ice cream shop trying to get some ice cream and they don't have any money.
Stand By Me is really good at that as well.
Yes. Yeah, where you just kind of wandering around, like you're enjoying the fact that you're outside and it's hot, but it's also too hot. I mean, it's not a film yet, and it is in the middle of being made into a film. But when we were talking about Do the Right Thing, In the Heights, the other Lin-Manuel Miranda musical is set over a sweltering 4th of July weekend in a blackout in the Washington Heights area of New York. Yeah. And that's part of the plot of that, really, that the heat escalates everything else that's going on, the tensions in the neighborhood that all the characters are feeling. So time traveling me from about a year and a half in the future is coming back to say In the Heights.
Whoa.
How was it? Wow. Was it good?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, John M. Chu smashed it.
Yeah? Good. You saw In the Heights, didn't you?
I'm also a time traveler, and
The play.
I did, yes, and it's very good.
Did you see it with the original cast?
No, I saw it here in London.
Interesting. So,
look, Chris.
I didn't see it either, but, you know, hey-ho.
Another film that I would suggest, well, really any film that's sort of hot would include a desert. Now, the old me would probably have used this as an opportunity to springboard into a tedious monologue about Denis Villeneuve's Dune. However, taken a personal
that's,
you know,
so impressive
step to curtail my Dune splainings. All I would say is possibly Dune.
I would agree with that, possibly Dune.
But is Dune about heat?
Yeah, because the entire planet is a desert and you will literally die if you spend any time outside not in a still suit.
Okay.
In large parts of the planet, obviously, not...
Tries not to explain a still suit.
Oh, God! A still suit basically is a covering of your entire body that basically recycles all the water that comes out of your body so you can survive, including we.
Okay.
Yes, all bodily fluids are recycled.
Don't you think it's interesting that there's never really a sense of heat in Star Wars? When they go to Tatooine, no one's putting on sun cream. No one's going, oh, God.
There is on Jakku.
Yeah, Jakku looks baking.
Because Finn, obviously, as soon as he reaches that fountain with the big rhino-y thing drinking, he's like straight in there.
Yeah.
Straight in it.
But also, I would say they're not really dressed for the desert, are they? You know, they're dressed in like big cloaks and heavy materials.
But that is dressed for the desert.
Is it?
Think of Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, but he was, you know, British.
Yeah.
An idiot.
And
that's
also,
that's how people dress when they're...
What about all of his...
All right, okay, you got me.
Yeah, okay.
Lawrence of Arabia was one I was going to say as well, though, in terms of heat shimmers, Omar Sharif's entrance.
God, yes.
Which is... I love heat haze, and it's very difficult to make it come across in camera. But yeah, that was really great. I'm also going to suggest, if we're going to talk about Spike Lee, Summer of Sam is also set in the heat wave.
True.
There's a great British B movie called The Day the Earth Caught Fire. If you haven't seen that, it's available on Blu-ray. Foul Guest.
And was that yesterday?
Well, it's literally about the sun essentially consuming the earth and scorching the earth, and it's set in a London where it is so almost too hot to go out. Wake and Fright. The great Australian film, Wake and Fright, if anyone's ever seen that, Ted
really,
Kotcheff.
Really any film set in Australia.
But this one in particular, because it is about a guy who goes to the outback. He's a relief teacher, he's a supply teacher, he goes out to this small Australian town, and there's nothing to do there but drink and gamble. And he gets caught in this sort of mire of drink and depression and Donald Pleasance, and there's a horrible sequence where they go out and shoot kangaroos, but the film itself is a nightmarish odyssey, and it really... They were literally throwing flies. I remember interviewing Ted Kotcheff about this and talking, how do you get the sense of heat on camera? But it was really, really hot. They literally shot out in the outback, you know, a bit like Mad Max and whatnot. But they were throwing flies at the actor's face, and they had hundreds of, if not thousands upon millions of flies knocking around the set.
I would also mention Ice Cold and Alex, just for that famous bit in the bar.
Oh, my God, yes.
And Pitch Black. It's actually very good.
Well, lest we forget more than that, the Chronicles of Riddick, which takes place on a fire planet called Crematoria, which isn't on the nose
at all. I've tried to avoid thinking ever about the Chronicles of Riddick.
Well, unfortunately, when we get to news, you're going to have to think about it again.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right.
I mean, we invoked it just there, but obviously, like Mad Max, all of them, but especially Fury Road. I have been hopelessly addicted to water for the last 27 years of my life. And
as a human.
So I really feel it when he's.
Being part water yourself, of course.
Yes. Whoa.
How do you feel?
Do you know what? All of this week, I felt like, you know, in the first X-Men where Senator Kelly is just that big kind of blobby, gooey water mass and he just explodes into water. That's basically been my state of being for the last week.
It's like that Star Trek The Next Generation villain who dissed the whole of humanity by calling us ugly bags of mostly water. Do you remember
wasn't,
that?
Wasn't that a nano item, a nano life form?
Wasn't it a silicone-based
life
form?
Yeah, but wasn't it like, and they speak to it via the Universal Translator. They have to work out how to communicate with it because it's killing the miners because they're like sentient minerals or something.
I can't remember what it was. I just remember ugly bags of mostly water.
This is a season one episode.
Yeah, it is. It's really early. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. That got nerdy. Anyway.
Yeah. It did get nerdy, didn't it? But yeah, we are all part water.
That's
true. Maybe that explains why we're so happy when we go into the sea. That we're coming home. We're going, Daddy, we missed you. Maybe, you know, just hypothetically speaking.
Sure.
Yeah? What is your problem here today, Helen?
What
is your problem?
I can't help having a skeptical face whenever
so
you open your mouth.
I'm angry with you. For some reason, I can't articulate. What is it? Two last films I'm going to mention before we move on. One is another Australian film, The Rover. Anyone seen The Rover? Robert Pattinson, Guy Pearce, from a few years ago. And again, it's like Mad Max is set in a kind of post-apocalyptic landscape and there's something has happened and a catastrophe that has beset the world and everything is sweat and everything is people just lying around in various states of undress because it's too hot to do anything else and there are no resources. And it's a really, really good film. If you haven't seen that, check it out. And of course, the opening of Once Upon a Time in the West.
Mm.
The amazing opening of Once Upon a Time in the West where three ne'er-do-wells are at a train station passing the time and waiting for Charles Bronson to show up in a train so they can murderalize him. But just like the good Dr. Kermode will with Jimbo, old Chuck Bronson gets a drop
we'll
on
find
them.
Out. We but will it's, discover.
It's an incredible evocation of heat because they're sitting there and there's nothing else to do except fan themselves and flies are buzzing around and water is dripping and the sound effects. It's like an 11-minute sequence. It's absolutely bravura. If you haven't seen Once Upon a Time in the West, then carve out 3 hours this weekend and check it out. If I could, of any film on this list, I would urge you to check out Once Upon a Time in the West and Do the Right Thing. And Predator, and 12 Angry Men, and basically every film we've mentioned.
You mentioning sound effects there just made me remember one that does a great job of evoking heat in black and white, which was Roma. The soundscape of Roma, of there is something about that that audibly gets across the sense of heat in a way that's really hard to explain.
You can just almost feel the sweat evaporate, hear the sweat evaporating, can't you?
Yeah, even though it is in black and white and you can't see the sort of bleached out sunlight, there's something about how insanely detailed that sort of soundscape is of Mexico City. It's in every bit of the sound design. It's kind of amazing.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good list. I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah. Why?
Why are you looking at me, Jimbo? Your face just annoys the hell out of me. Hey, sorry, guys.
I'll kill you as the starter and Kermode will be the main course. It begins here.
It's so damn hot. Milk was a bad choice.
We didn't even mention that one.
We didn't even mention it, and we should have done. The greatest exploration of the effect of heat on the human psyche. Anchorman. James is fully on board with it.
Ugh.
Of course you don't like Anchorman. I was about to say, you don't like Anchorman, but of course you don't like
dreadful.
Anchorman.
Let's get on with it. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can do so via a number of methods. You can do so on Twitter as Adam Stark. Found out, much to his cost. We're on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast or chances are we won't see it. We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine and we're on email as well, podcast@empireonline.com. A couple of quick things before we move on to the news portion of the show. Again, we're doing our live show at the London Podcast Festival on September 14th. Tickets are on sale right now. There's a whole bunch of film-related podcasts and other great podcasts that have nothing to do with film. And if you want to go see them, The Good Dr. Kermode, you want to see Anna Smith's Girls on Film podcast, you want to see Sam Clements do 90 Minutes or Less live. I'm missing a whole bunch of other ones, but there are some great, great film podcasts that are going to be there as well. If you buy tickets to 3 or more shows at kingsplace.co.uk, then you get a discount. We're doing a live show Saturday, September 14th, starting quite late in the day. We're closing the day. And I think it's 9:30 start. But yeah, tickets are available right now. And we would love to see you there. Please do join us. And also,
It's worth mentioning, if you buy tickets to the Kermode podcast and not the Pilot TV podcast, you are never allowed to listen to the Empire podcast again.
Yes, we have ways of monitoring this.
Yes.
We will make sure that...
That's a rule.
We have people on this sort of thing. And but one last thing, we want you to join us for that, but we also want to join you for a very special podcast that we will record in someone's home or the workplace or school or wherever, because we're a part of an auction to raise money for a very, very worthy cause If you go to 32auctions.com and you search for the Empire Podcast, you will be able to bid to have us come and record a podcast wherever you want, as long as it's within the British Isles. Mainland Britain, should I say. Mainland Britain. And the bidding currently stands at £450 and it closes on July 28th at 3 p.m. BST. And I would like to see us get it up.
£450? Yeah. Come on.
We could do better than that, surely.
I don't get out of bed for less than £1,000.
Yeah. You can have James Dyer June explain to you in the comfort of your own living room, and that's got to be worth at least £27.50.
It's got to be worth more than that.
We'll then do a fundraiser to make James leave as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. James likes your house. He will take it over. That's how it works. So go to 32auctions.com, search Empire Podcast, and then do a bid. Do a big old bid, and we could be recording in your home. How exciting.
Hurrah.
Okay, so now it's time to talk about the movie news that's happened all week. Now, there was a lot of movie news, and a lot of it was Marvel-related at the San Diego Comic-Con in the Marvel Studios presentation. And we figured that talking about that would take a fair old chunk of time. So rather than take 20 minutes of this podcast to go through that, we're going to do that separately, and that's going to be up by the time you listen to this. In fact, it will be available as a very, very short-ish Empire Podcast, Marvel Cinematic Universe, Comic-Con special, so we'll talk about that later on. But just get a quick reaction to you guys about all the stuff that happened. So Doctor Strange, The Multiverse of Madness, Thor, Love and Thunder, Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, Black Widow solo movie, all the TV stuff on Disney+, and the other movie that I'm forgetting, which is...
Eternals,
yes. Happy with that? Yes.
Ooh.
Sure.
Yeah.
Good? Yay, happy? Squee, yeah. Et cetera. Yeah.
Okay, well done. Thank you very much indeed. And now we can talk about stuff that isn't Marvel related.
Hurrah!
Spider-Man Far From Home became the first Spider-Man movie to cross the billion-dollar mark this weekend. And, of course, finally, at long last, Avengers Endgame has become the biggest movie of all time.
Indeed.
Helen, did you tip it over the edge?
I haven't been to see it since my 8th time. So, really?
8 times? Really?
I went with you. We went to see the reissue.
But that was my 6th. I didn't think you were too ahead of me. Well, first you go to see Hamilton with Linny Manny.
Yeah.
And now you do this.
I mean, I just can't
even
help
look
it.
At you now.
Well... That's the way it goes, Chris. I mean, there is the possibility that they will reissue Avatar before Avatar 2 comes out, in which case it genuinely might not stand for very long.
Big old arms race.
It is a bit of an arms race, so we will see. But yeah, I mean, hooray and good work, Spidey. That is $3 billion movies this year.
Yeah.
From Marvel. And I think this is apparently only Sony's second $2 billion grosser after Skyfall.
Yeah.
So this may usher in a new age for them as well.
Very interesting stuff, of course. And did you know the identity of the last Marvel Cinematic Universe movie that didn't make a billion?
Ant-Man and the Wasp.
That is correct, Ben. Yay. Travis.
Everyone's favourite.
I mean, where's the justice in that?
Walton no, the Goggins, Justice League is the other one.
Walton yeah. Goggins goes out of his way to create an indelible, memorable character in Sonny Birch. He wore Sunny. Shoes with no... Sonny Birch. Yeah, you must Sunny. Remember Sonny Birch.
Right, sure.
And how do people repay him? Only repelling the film to just $600 million worldwide.
I think it
should be re-released.
The humiliation. Uh-huh. The shame.
Endgame style re-release of Ant-Man and the Wasp with one deleted scene that isn't finished and an introduction from... because there's only one director, so because they only did one Russo.
So
just
half
of Peyton Reed.
No, but they could.
Bottom half or top
they
half.
They could re-release it. What they could do is they could cut in some character development for Evangeline Lilly and then they could re-release it as a proper film.
That's right.
And then, as a post-credits postscript, you just watch all of Endgame.
Now that could make some money.
Why do you guys hate Sonny Birch?
I don't hate Sonny Birch.
I don't know why Sonny Birch is there. Yeah. And I have seen the film several times, but I don't hate him.
Anyway, that's exciting news. Well done, Commerce, and well done, Giant.
Well done, Commerce.
Well done, Commerce, and well done, Giant, great, big, multinational corporation.
Yep. Lots of good trailers and exciting trailers this week that are probably worth a mention.
There were.
Zombieland Double Tap, good title, happy with that. Brings back the original cast. They take over the White House. Yeah. We know that much. And they do seem to have a weird doppelganger situation going
on. Yeah, I wasn't wild about this.
Well, no, I liked it in a sort of Shaun of the Dead style, right? If it's that kind of thing. I'm intrigued to see who they've got as the other Emma Stone, because obviously they were kind of holding back on that, I guess. We saw the other Tallahassee and the other whatever Jesse Eisenberg's name was, but we haven't seen the other whatever Emma Stone's name was.
It's a decent gag, but it did feel a little bit galling that they literally took it from Shaun of the Dead, from the other zombie comedy. It felt a little bit kind of...
But there, that's one shot. It's a really funny gag. Here, if there's something else to it, the fact, you know, there's another reason why they bump them into doppelgangers, and I'm on board with it. Also, Thomas Middleditch is hilarious. So, very, very excited.
And I'm
never
not happy to see Luke Wilson. I think he's great. So,
absolutely.
It looks as well like Luke Wilson's character, not only being the Tallahassee of the group, but there's definitely an element of Rick Grimes about him when he steps out there with his scruffy beard and his big belt full
of... That's right. The first Zombie Land was pre-Walking Dead. Now it's post-Walking Dead, so...
It's nuts that was 10 years ago, and that was Emma Stone pre, like, even Easy A. She'd done Superbad by that point, but she hadn't done Easy A. Jesse Eisenberg pre-Social Network. So it's kind of amazing that they got everyone back for this.
It is, yeah. I like Zombieland. Zombieland is so much fun. Mm-hmm. And this trailer didn't... It felt a little unsophisticated. I think that's what bothered me. I mean, look, let's not pretend Zombieland is hugely sophisticated, but it worked. It was very stylistic, and it wasn't stupid. And the doppelganger thing made me worry that this was going to be stupid. I may be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I'm looking forward to seeing this, but this did not knock me over.
I like the fact that they're doing a sort of coming-of-age trope where this unit has basically been a family for 10 years, and then it's like, ooh... Like they're starting to get partners and break apart, and just following that thread of if these people have been hanging out for 10 years, even though it's the zombie apocalypse, you'd still have those sort of milestones in life. So I quite like that seems to be one of the main thrusts of this one. Mm.
I don't think that Ruben Fleischer's covered himself in glory as a director since then. What was it, 30 minutes or less, which actually should have been 30 minutes or fewer? Gangster Squad, Venom. These are not great films, but hopefully this could be returned to form. And the fact that Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who are the writers of the original movie, are back on board, and the fact they managed to get everyone back, and the fact that Rosario Dawson's in it as well. Yes. Yeah. More Rosario Dawson, please, in everything. Makes me very, very happy indeed. Although the most unrealistic thing about this movie set in a post-apocalyptic landscape filled with zombies is that one group of people would be together just doing the same thing over and over again for 10 years. And I find that deeply unrealistic. James,
you'd never, never find
that,
us.
That wouldn't happen. They'd have killed each other.
Yeah,
done other things
day after day, day
gone
in,
on
day
to
out.
Do other things.
Yeah,
like better jobs.
Yeah, evolved,
higher paid things.
Evolved in some way, and
the formula. Who would do the same tedious formula
over and over
without any kind of evolution growth or
hairstyle change?
Yeah,
in some cases, underwear change. I mean,
it stretches credulity.
Just the
I think.
Same beats over.
But then
and
to
over.
Bring in new members, like to bring in like young, like a
fresh
token
blood.
Young person, like
fresh
a token, as if that's gonna somehow make it fresh.
I like that idea.
But it won't.
It won't.
Because ultimately, they're just stuck staring at the same faces. I can't even look at the same faces.
Oh,
I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I can't. I'm so angry, why did you see it eight times? Anyway, I just think that that didn't ring true to me.
Mm. No.
This might be the only zombie apocalypse film where the zombie apocalypse isn't technically a dystopia, because this is a world where the Trump presidency never happened.
Yeah.
Like, what if we could actually live in the Zombieland world? Wouldn't that be nice?
It does make you kind of wistful, doesn't it? Although we might be not living so much as unliving or actually dead. So, you know, you've got to put that in perspective.
Yeah.
I guess.
Also,
this week was the Harriet trailer, which is the Harriet Tubman biopic with Cynthia Erivo starring as the woman who basically was a key member, a key figure in the Underground Railroad that helped slaves in the U.S. South escape to safety and freedom in the North. She's the one that they're planning to put on the $20 bill that Trump keeps trying to block.
I wonder why he keeps trying to block
that. It's so weird, isn't it? It's so strange. Interestingly, she was going to be on the $10 and she was going to replace Alexander Hamilton. And then
Alexander Hamilton.
You were going to do that. I knew it.
And then Hamilton happened. And genuinely, there was an outcry about taking him off the currency. And so she was moved to the $20 bill, which is better anyway, because she's replacing Andrew Jackson, I think, who was horrible. So anyway, the trailer is up. This is very much a sort of, I feel like it's going to be a fairly mainstream action heavy by the looks of this trailer. Although, in fairness, this could be the entire total of the action in the film. Take on her life, but she was an extraordinary woman. She was about 4 foot nothing. And the reason she could help all these people escape was that she was sent as a one-woman truck company, because she could load up these huge wagons by herself and then drive these huge wagon teams by herself. And that's why she was able to go around in relative freedom and actually help people and rescue people.
And she has escaped from slavery herself and then dedicated her life to getting other people out of slavery. It looks like an incredible story, and it's something that we don't get taught here in schools. I think she's a relatively kind of high-profile figure in American history lessons and that kind of thing, that Americans will know who Harriet Tubman is. But I think a lot of people in the UK kind of don't. And even if this is a fairly straightforward telling of her story, it seems like something that we really need right now, just for this kind of story to be told to a much bigger audience. Yeah. And Cynthia Erivo looks incredible.
She's stunning. So it's Cassie Lemons directing. It's also got Janelle Monáe in it. It's also got the aforementioned Leslie Odom Jr.
Yes.
So it's looking pretty good to me, I have to say.
Speaking of Janelle Monáe, she signed on this week to star in Homecoming Season 2, which was a Julia Roberts fronted show on Amazon that I never saw, but Jimbo, I presume you did?
No, as it happens, although weirdly I went round to my mum's house last night and she was watching it, so if you like I can get her on the phone, she can tell us what she thought of it.
Okay.
I seem to recall she said it was quite confusing.
I believe it is, intentionally so though. And this is, Julia Roberts is not returning for season two, but they've drafted in Janelle Monáe to play a new character, a woman who wakes up in a canoe with no memory of who she is or how she got there. So sounds exciting, and it may have some cast members returning from the first season as well. Incidentally, I have Google Home, and if you ask it to play Janelle Monáe on Spotify, it goes, "Playing Janelle Monáe." So either we've been pronouncing it wrong, or
no,
Google is.
Google is. It doesn't understand acute, I think.
Bet Alexa would get it right.
Hey, speaking of things we don't understand, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's new film, I'm a little confused by.
The Last Duel.
The Last Duel. So this has apparently got Ridley Scott looking to direct and Nicole Holofcener working on the script with Damon and Affleck.
Yes.
This is all quite cool. So that collection of people, great people, love them. The story, though, is a lot. So this is a Norman knight, Jean de Carrouges, and his squire, Jacques Le Gris. And they were friends, and Jean goes off to war, and Le Gris is accused of raping Jean's wife when Jean gets home.
Mm-hmm.
So then no one believes her, obviously. So Jean, I think, then appeals to the King of France to undo the decision that she's lying, and they have to fight a duel to the death. And basically, if the husband loses, he and his wife will be killed because they will be considered to have lied. And if he kills his friend, then that will be his only route to justice. I don't know. This is a really weird subject, I feel like. And I'm comforted that Nicole Holofcener is in there because I think she's great and very smart and maybe more sensitive to some of these issues than perhaps Matt Damon has shown himself to be in the past, despite, I think, his very good intentions.
Mm.
But it strikes me as something that has a large potential to be disastrous.
But Ridley Scott directing the first screenplay by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon since Good Will Hunting, with Nicole Holofcener, who's brilliant, involved as well. I think this could be brilliant. I understand the subject matter. I saw someone on Twitter railing against this week. I was like, oh, this sounds great. Brilliant. Line up the Oscars. This is going to, fantastic. Because they haven't written together since Good Will Hunting, which is crazy when you think about it. They've both written separately for themselves, and Damon's written for Gus Van Sant and worked on some of the Bourne movies as a writer as well. And you're thinking, okay, this is interesting. Why haven't they worked together? Obviously, they had their careers and they focused on acting and their careers diverged, but they were really... Good Will Hunting's a fantastic screenplay.
Yeah.
And obviously, there was lots of rumors flying around about William Goldman's involvement in it, but I don't think that was the case at all. I think he gave him the advice, but he didn't. They wrote that screenplay. And so I'm really excited to see a screenplay from them again. And yes, it's tackling a really dark subject, but...
Right. The reason that this could be great is precisely because we're in a time when there's a whole lot of discussions about who we believe, who we consider credible, what gets taken seriously and what doesn't. That's also the reason that it could be horribly wrong. And I feel like there is the potential for ham-fisted addressing of the questions of rape and the questions of who believes whom when it comes to accusations and the questions of where justice lies, basically. I realize that this is set hundreds of years ago. I like all of these people involved. I'm just a little wary of all potential pitfalls.
I share your concerns for very much the same reasons, but hope for the best.
Yeah.
I think they're all very, very smart people. They're all very, very talented. I'm excited about this.
They are very smart people, but like if you think about the ways that Matt Damon has put his foot in it several times in recent years, and I believe he's a very well-meaning person.
Yeah, I don't think that Matt Damon's cancelled, for example. I've seen an awful lot going around this week. Dear God. I'm hopeful that they make a good movie. And I'm excited about Ridley Scott, who, of course, began his directorial career with The Duelists, making a film called The Last Duel.
Beyond the sort of politics of the story, will there be a song where perchance they sort of explain the 10 commandments of a duel and explain how a duel works in 10 handy steps? I'm trying to think if that's ever been done before.
Has that ever been done, I wonder, in a
like
musical?
The 10 duel commandments
10
or something?
Commandments. It's a catchy title anyway, Ben.
I think there's something in there.
Someone should look into that.
Yeah.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, maybe.
I can't help feeling something's happening that I don't understand.
It's a song in Hamilton.
Oh, good God. Speaking of things that no one can really understand, Vin Diesel has been on social media this week, which is always entertaining, in this case to tell us that the script for Riddick 4 Furia is now a thing. It is finished. It is done. It's the film the world has been clamouring for since we saw The Chronicles of Riddick. So this is the thing
and
that's
Riddick
happening.
Don't forget Riddick.
Oh, and who can forget
Riddick?
I mean,
I'm trying, but yeah, you shouldn't.
It's
you
one
know.
Of those things. It's so funny because Pitch Black is such a good film
such
and came
movie.
Out of nowhere, and it's incredible. But unfortunately, what's good about Pitch Black largely is, yes, Riddick is a character, but it was the concept, the idea that this is a guy who can see in the dark and he's in a planet where it's night and the things come out at night and it all just fits together into this brilliant horror film. And then David Toohey decided he wanted to turn it into a sci-fi Lord of the Rings. So then you got this huge, broad, political, incredibly on-the-nose film.
Incoherent.
Incoherent nonsense with crematoria, the prison flame planet, and then baddies called the Necromongers.
Mm.
And it was just like, seriously. And that's when we found out that Riddick was a quote-unquote Furian.
Furian, yeah.
And then we have a brief interlude in Riddick where they try and recapture the concept of Pitch Black, but make it a little bit creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very creepy. Mm-hmm. Poor Starbuck. And now this. Now, originally, he'd spoken about this film before. Before this was written, I believe Riddick said, it's just Riddick, Diesel said that this would be an origin story.
Oh, no.
Now, I don't know if it's going to be one, but I don't know that he knew he was a Furian. Am I right in saying this? Why am I looking at you? You don't know, do you?
I don't remember.
I don't think he knew he was a Furian. So
I
an origin
played the
story
games,
would
though.
Just be him.
Nobody knows.
Nobody cares.
And nobody cares.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Except for David Toohey and Vin Diesel.
I mean, you're not wrong.
No, I mean, I want to have goodwill towards this franchise because I love the first film, like
Guys.
James.
Judi Dench.
Exactly.
Was in The Chronicles of Riddick.
As a freaking angel
As
person.
An angel.
And I love that kind of crazy cat. And the casting of that film is great. Colin Fiore,
Carl
Urban,
yeah.
Tandy Newton. Yeah. I mean, that's great people. The problem was just it made no sense. And then Riddick would have been it was a really forgettable sci-fi. Like, even apart from the creepiness and the sexism, it was just forgettable.
I remember nothing about it.
Yeah.
They were on a planet. There was a beacon for aid and then some people. I don't know.
And what made the aliens come out on that one, I've forgotten.
Were they under
the ground? Yeah, they were under the ground and they came out of the ground, but I can't remember what caused them to come out of the ground. It wasn't night. In the first film, when it's night, the monsters come out. On this, I think, I could be making this up, when it rained, they came out of the ground.
There's a chance we're spending too long on these movies.
Yeah.
You think?
There's a chance.
There's a chance David Toohey spent too long on these movies.
There was other fantasy news that I was interested in, which was the news that Catherine Hardwick is set to direct Heathen, which is based on a comic. And I saw a sort of pre-vizzy kind of thing for this. I don't know if I'm allowed to mention that. I think I am. Anyway, I saw a thing for this, which was very cool. So it's basically about a female Viking warrior, which is a real historical thing. They actually existed. It's not just in the series Vikings. And she's scorned by her village because she kisses another woman. So she basically decides this whole patriarchy thing is not good. I'm going to go and kill Odin, who obviously is responsible for it. And that's kind of the story. So it's basically this warrior trying to kill the king of the gods.
Awesome.
Sounds cool. Yep.
And Catherine Hardwick's cool and I think deserves the chance to do something a bit action-y and interesting.
There is a sense, weirdly, since she directed, since Twilight, that she's almost been in movie jail, which only seems to happen, of course, to female directors. Mm. And she's struggled to get movies off the ground since then. So it's good to see that that's happening. Hopefully that will happen very, very soon. But we should talk about the Picard trailer, which debuted at Comic-Con and which sent Twitter into raptures.
Yeah.
Mm.
And not just Twitter, I'm guessing, right?
Pretty much.
Oh, yes, yes. We missed this by like a day on the pilot podcast, and I think the entire listenership was very relieved. I mean, I've been banging on about Picard for ages, and all of the marketing to date has been quite vineyard-based. Mm. Like, we've had images of vines, we've had him standing in a vineyard with a dog. You know, we haven't had anything that
we've had wine labels.
We've had wine labels. I mean, Christ. And then this gave you the Borg, it gave you Romulans, it gave you 7 of 9, it gave you Data.
Like, Data!
Oh my God, there was so much going on here. And they haven't laid out what this is about, but it seems to be that something has happened to Picard, Admiral Picard, to get mm-hmm. him to leave Starfleet 10 years ago. Now, it seems to tally up with something that Leonard Nimoy says in Star Trek 2009 film about the destruction of Romulus. So it seems to be the demise of the Romulan Empire.
Because there's that line about the greatest rescue effort in history.
And I think he's part of that rescue effort. And something about that causes him to hand in his commission and basically go back to making wine. He meets a young woman who seems to have some sort of portentous heritage. She's referred to as the Destroyer at one point. And he puts together a motley crew of people, including a Treadaway. Including motley crew and a Treadaway, which is both things you want. And
is there a scene with the cast of the crew of the Enterprise stick their dicks in burritos? So that, okay, anyway.
But interestingly here, so you see there's a Borg cube in this. 7 of 9 makes an appearance, looking like she's grown as a character since the end of Voyager.
7 of 9's ever met Picard.
She hasn't. Right. But she's mates with Janeway, and Janeway knows Picard, so presumably they met at a dinner party.
Big shock.
So she goes to see him. There's like what looks like some sort of ersatz penal colony, and there's a sign that says it's been 5,000 plus days since an assimilation. So is that in a Borg cube? Are they Borg prisoners? It seems to be Borg related, so there seems to be a lot of Borg action in this.
Yeah, the cube seems to be being worked on.
Yeah,
and like it's not quite clear.
And it's also blue light in it, not green light, so you wonder whether it's an old cube. So there seems to be that. Well, I think what's most exciting about this is we've not played in this timelines. It's been 20 years since Nemesis, and we've done lots of Star Trek things, but we've never found out what happened post Nemesis. You know, we've never seen what happens to the universe
It's understandably post Nemesis. Everyone just kind of went.
Nemesis.
Like Deep Space Nine ended, Voyager ended, Next Gen ended. All these things stopped, and then
it's fertile grounds. What you're saying.
Exactly. And I'm fascinated. You know, what is the state of the Romulan Empire after the destruction of Romulus? You know, what happened to the Borg post First Contact? You know, all and post the finale of Voyager. There's lots of exciting things that I want to know.
And also just seeing Captain Picard be Captain Picard again, Admiral, whichever, and seeing him talk to Data, that just destroyed me. I'm just like, oh my God, I didn't know how much I needed this back in my life. I need it back in my life.
Course, it was confirmed that we will see Riker and Troi as well.
We will indeed. Also, Jonathan Del Arco is in this, and he played Hugh in I, Borg. Do you remember this? And Descent.
Yeah.
So he was the kind of self-aware Borg that gets released back to the collective. Now, he was on the panel and he's in it. We don't know if he's reprising that role, though we can assume he is. And there is a kind of naked man in the trailer who looks like he's had implants removed. That might have been him. I couldn't tell.
Does Picard still have part of Locutus still in him? Does he still have that?
I think he carries the emotional baggage. He doesn't have any implants.
And for example, if they were to commandeer an old, unfinished Borg vessel, would he be able to pilot it?
I don't think so. Though he hears the Borg in First Contact, at the beginning, he hears them. Mm. Like, when they converge, he does hear them coming. So there's something going
on
there.
Just throwing it out there.
I don't know. In a post-Alice Krieg world, like, the Borg are not quite what they were.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Exciting times, though.
Very exciting.
Despite Akiva Goldsman's presence. Exciting times.
Despite that.
2020.
Yeah. Early 2020.
Early 2020.
This is the new Dune for me. I'm moved on from Dune. It's all about Picard now.
Oh, wow, I'm telling Dune.
Oh, Christ. All excitement for Picard is now gone out the window. but yeah, very, very exciting indeed. Just a couple of last very, very quick things. It was announced just before Comic-Con. I'm not sure if it was announced as part of Comic-Con or not, but there are 2 more Halloween movies about to start shooting, and they're about to start shooting back-to-back. And they'll have David Gordon Green as director and Danny McBride as co-writer and Jamie Lee Curtis as a star. And they're called Halloween Kills, which will be out next year, around October. And then Halloween Ends in 2021.
It won't though, will it?
I think this version of it will.
Okay.
But I'm not sure about reboots and remakes and whatnot.
Shooting back to back seems wise though, because that way you can maximize your field of vision.
But I don't know what they're going to do, because Michael Myers obviously died at the end of the last Halloween.
Spoiler!
So, you know,
That's never stopped them before.
I'm sure there's no way he's going to be coming back.
Nope.
That's going to happen. I wasn't a huge fan of that David Gordon Green Halloween, I'll be completely honest. I felt that it hit all the same beats that Halloween H2O did 20 years earlier, but just not as well. But I'm hopeful that maybe they'll be able to
bring back Josh Hartnett.
That would be good.
That would be good. I really liked the recent Halloween. I know we just have different opinions on this one. I'm kind of intrigued, though, because what I liked about the recent Halloween was it was a very clear idea, the sort of ignore all the other sequels, follow up with Laurie sort of 40 years later, that was a very clean thread into a new take on the story and on the mythos. And then sequelizing it, I mean, it's great that you have those characters to play with, but I wonder what the idea behind that's going to be. There was a very clear concept to what they wanted to do with the recent Halloween. So I'm intrigued, especially that they're doing the back-to-back thing, if it's going to be a story that spans both of those films or if they're just rolling with this cast. Because for me, I thought the cast worked really well. I don't know.
There were things I liked about it. I'm not writing it off by any stretch of the imagination, but I just thought that it wasn't as good or elegant as a horror film, and it was weirdly celebratory in its attitude towards Michael Myers, which I don't think it should have been, but, you know, hey-ho. I wish them all the best. You could argue, of course, that having two horror films back-to-back, knowing that there's a third one coming out, might dissipate tension somewhat. Maybe. But we shall see. And finally, some very, very sad news to end off the news section. We lost two very, very great character actors this week. First off, the British actor Jeremy Kemp, who people might know from his role in, well, if anyone listening to this podcast has seen Said Cars, I'll be absolutely amazed, but he shot the fame in Said Cars, which is the famous cop TV drama. Then he was in The Likes of the Blue Max. He played Picard's brother in Next Gen.
Of course he did. Mm-hmm. The one who persuades him to leave the vineyard and go back to Starfleet after he has suffered assimilation at the hands of the Borg.
So he was great in that, but I will always remember him. He was General Strick in Top Secret, which is a film I never bang on about here on the podcast. He is at the center of two of his best jokes. So one is the phone conversation where, in fact, I think it's the same thing. I think it's exactly the same scene where he gets a phone call. There is a phone in the foreground. The phone is massive in the foreground.
It's
in the foreground. And he's in... He's in the background. He walks over to the phone. He picks it up. The phone is giant. It's an amazing side gag.
And then he has that incredible, incredible line. He's on the phone to the hospital. Yes. He goes, well, let me know if his condition changes. He puts down the phone and goes, he's dead.
And he played it absolutely so straight. So good. So very, very good indeed. He was 84 and he passed away. So Jeremy Kemp, he shall be missed. Mm. And then, of course, it was Rutger Hauer. The great Rutger Hauer, who died this week at 75. And this one hit me hard a little bit, I'll be honest with you, because I thought, honestly, he was made of oak.
Yeah.
I did not imagine him to succumb in his mid-70s, or indeed at all. And he's just an incredible actor, Dutch actor, shot to fame in his homeland with movies like Soldier of Orange and Spetters for Paul Verhoeven. And he caught the eye of Hollywood and went over to Hollywood. And because of his looks, he was tall, he was blonde, he had these piercing blue-grey eyes, and he was intimidating. He was an intimidating figure. And so Hollywood stuck him into a load of bad guy roles. Mm. But the interesting thing about Rutger Hauer is that he actually managed to break out of that stuff. He managed to break out of the mold of bad guys. You know, Nighthawks, if anyone's ever seen that film, the Sly Stallone film.
Lady Hawk.
Yeah, because he managed to somehow then become almost a romantic lead in films like Lady Hawk and an action hero in films like My Beloved Blind Fury. Mm. And he was
Split second. Salute of the Jugger.
Oh my God. What a guy. What a legend. The Hitcher. The Hitcher is a fucking amazing film. If you haven't seen The Hitcher, the original Hitcher, ignore the Sean Bean remake. I was on set of that. Farrago. No, don't go near there. But do go check out the original. It's an incredible, incredible film, and he is terrifying in it as basically the devil. And then, of course, there's Blade Runner.
And then there's Blade Runner, which is, I mean, that was the thing that everybody was posting pictures from. Everybody was, of course, posting those final words from Blade Runner the other night, because they're just monumental. They're, you know, it's one of the finest moments. It's certainly one of the finest deaths in cinema history. And a lot of that came from him, and he had real creative input into that moment. And, of course, Ridley Scott had the sense to see that he had something gold and go with it, you know. But it's an incredible, incredible scene, and of course, it's an incredible memorial to him.
Yeah, I think that moment, I know it's the easy one to go to for Rutger Hauer, but it's one of my all-time favourite film scenes. There is so much mystery to that scene, but it also tells you so much at the same time. It tells you the impossible vastness of what somebody sees in their life that will always be completely unknowable.
Of what we lose when we lose anyone.
Like, not to get too highfalutin about it, but like the sort of essence of humanity and mortality and the human experience that in the space of like a minute cuts to the very heart of that is absolutely astonishing. It's just one of the most beautiful, beautiful film scenes of all time, I'd say.
If you like that, Ben, you're going to love Blind Fury, in which he plays a Vietnam veteran who is blind but is also a master swordsman. It's an
is
incredible
he furious?
Film. No, he's not that mad, actually. No, until out. The end, yeah.
Does he use his sword to cut to the very heart of the human experience?
He cuts to the heart of many humans.
And in later years, as he got craggier, he was a Batman Begins, Hobo with a Shotgun, The Last Kingdom. Incredible, incredible actor.
True Blood. He was a fairy godfather.
I had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of times, and he was an awesome, awesome dude. Very laconic, very laid back. I used to see the story that the Galway Film Festival put up this week, that they had him as a guest in 1993, and he just rocked up on a motorbike, apparently, and just had a hoolie for a couple of days, left saying, I've just met the last wild man in the world. And then they offered to reimburse him for his trouble. He went, I've got more money than this festival. You keep it. And off he went. But in a nice way, not a horrible way. He was an incredible, incredible guy. Rutger Hauer, he will be missed. Time now for this week's guests. Jimbo, Animals.
Animals.
It's an exciting film, isn't it?
It is an exciting film.
Yes. What's it about?
I think it's been described as With Nell for Girls, which I thought was incredibly reductive. So I decided to call it Fight Club for Women because that's just as reductive.
But it's, thanks, James.
That's really helped.
Alia Shawkat and Holly Granger play young women in their 20s who are sort of hard living, hard drinking. And Holly Granger's character meets a young man, played by Frafay, and that taxes their, shall we say, hard-living friendship. What's really good about this, I think, is it portrays these women as actual, you know, proper, rounded, unapologetic characters. You know, they drink, they sleep with whoever they want to, they act like actual humans and are not restrained by the expectations that society, and let's be honest, films, often put on female leads. And it's really refreshing, and they're great characters. I really enjoyed this film. I had loads of fun with it. And they were quite fun to talk to as well.
Okay, so this is Holiday Granger and Alia Shawkat from Arrested Development, a show you've never seen.
I have seen it. I've not watched all of it. I watched the first season and then a couple of others, but then realised it was trying to be funny, and you know how I feel about that.
Those comedies will insist on doing that. And in some cases, in the case of maybe Arrested Development, they
succeed.
But
not of late, though.
But you are a Borg.
I am.
Therefore,
resistance is futile.
Yeah, very much so. But anyway, here we go. James talking to Holiday Granger. And if you're listening to this, America, Vacation Granger. And Alia Shawkat, do please enjoy.
Holiday Granger, Alia Shawkat, welcome to the Empire podcast.
Hello.
How are you?
All right.
Good, good, good.
Yep.
So, I've seen the film, which I very much enjoyed. People listening to this will not have seen the film. So, for those who haven't yet had a chance, can you tell us a little bit about these two women around whom this whole thing revolves?
Yes. It's a story about Laura and Tyler.
Yeah.
Last name's not necessary. It's about two best friends who live in Dublin, Ireland, and know how to have a crack. I always use that word
Don't
wrong.
Have
the crack. Right?
Have crack.
Okay, yeah, have crack. Which means a good time.
We still have not learned that.
So it's, no, like, it's been a year. I know. All our friends are going to be, Sal's going to be so disappointed with us. But yeah, two girls know how to have a great old time, maybe too much. And they're reaching a point in their lives where priorities are starting to shift.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is obviously based on a book, which is not set in Dublin at all, but instead set in Manchester.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I guess, why was it a logistical change? Like, why the... Because it's all about Dublin, this is very... Like, the city is a big part of this film. And in the book, it is... Well, Manchester's very much a part of it, too. So I guess, why the change?
Finances.
Really?
Yes.
It's just cheaper to shoot in Dublin.
Yeah.
It's not quite as romantic a story, is it? It's you were about to say the legacy and the poets.
But it all was meant to be because it did feed all those things.
I know.
Dublin was meant to be.
Funny that she, like Laura in the book, her biggest inspiration is Yeats. And then we were in Dublin and I was, you know, and it's just so, yeah, it all made sense literarily.
Yeah.
And also I think that it was when we moved, when Sophie called me to say we might not be able to like secure funding in England, but in Ireland we can.
Yeah,
I was like, a bit of my heart was like, because I have a like that Manchester pride thing, and love the book because I knew everywhere in it and I knew them, but I love Dublin as a city anyway. I spent quite a bit of time there. And I've always wanted to do an Irish accent. And I think that it's quite transferable, actually. I think the Irish and the English are very different but I think Dubliners and Mancunians are quite similar. And as cities, it's quite, they're kind of, they've both got a very strong literary and musical history, and there's a pride and a no-nonsense attitude that people have, I think.
Yeah.
And so it all made sense to just, like, it was very easy to, like, pick up and move.
How long did you get to spend there?
About like 6 weeks altogether, yeah. I think. 6 to 7 weeks, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, what did you get to go out there before it all started and just sort of drink in the place?
Yeah, we had rehearsals.
Yeah.
As well as drinking in the place.
Yeah. I was about to say, surely they're one of the same thing, really, for this, isn't it? Is there a sense that, like, rehearsals is let's hit Dublin and get twatted? You know, yeah. That's
part of it. And then also script work and,
yeah.
And getting to know each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a combination. Sophie had a lot of great rehearsal exercises. Character work, sharing stories, spending time together, practicing bigger scenes. So by the time we were actually shooting them, we kind of had a blocking already set up. And then, yeah, then going to bars, having these kind of fun assignments where we would, you know, Holly and I would be sent to the bar we'd be shooting in later and just have an assignment to go get a drink there and hang out. So it was a combination of, yeah, like falling in love with the city as much as with these characters.
Mm. That's not the worst assignment, I guess, you can be
no,
given.
Not at all. It's a pretty good job.
But you have homework. Well, you
yeah, loads of homework, rounds of homework. But it's interesting you talk about exercises, because this whole thing hinges on the relationship between you two being very authentic, which it is. But of course, you didn't necessarily know each other, and you almost certainly didn't have to audition for this, so there wasn't like a chemistry test or anything. So was it just a case of trying to organically build this, or is just going out in the town in Dublin the way to do that?
I guess it was, you know, a little combo of both.
Yeah.
But we got lucky.
We kind of, as well, we knew of each other beforehand. Mm. It's like, I mean, I already had an impression of Alia. I was just like, I like this girl. I'd made my mind up before I met her.
I mean, that helps.
Thank God for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, chemistry's a hard thing to define. It's a lot of risk. Like, most films, there's usually a character, not all, but like where it really depends, especially in like romantic storylines. You're like, well, let's just hope this works out. And sometimes, you know, there's amazing chemistry and those people end up working together in many films afterwards. But it's not really something that you can 100% know if it works. So, it was, you know, Sophie's decision to cast us, Holiday was attached to it before I was. And I told Holiday this, but my mom always used to think that we should work together. She was like, you and this actress, Holiday Granger, I think would be wonderful together. And I was like, all right, I'll try and make it happen. And then I was like, guess what? I'm playing her best friend.
So she's thrilled.
Yeah, so she's happy about it. But yeah, I think it was just, we were kind of lucky. And then we both have similar, you know, temperaments with the way that we approach our work. And then, yeah, we just like hit it off. So yeah, we were lucky that way.
It's funny you mention romance, because the way the film starts is about when the two characters first meet, and it feels like a traditional kind of romantic setup, which I guess makes sense, because in many ways it is a bit of a love story between these two friends and the evolution of that relationship. Like, was that part of the appeal of kind of doing this? Because you don't get that an awful lot, you know, where it kind of prioritizes almost like a platonic friendship over romantic relationships, which films don't tend to do.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the draws for me of the book when I first read it, aside from Manchester. Because like, female friendships is probably one of the most important things in my life. I have really close friends, and that's quite often in films very underrepresented, because it's quite often like the second, you know, it's the secondary to the love story.
Yeah.
Or you see a lot of like male friendships on screen, but it hasn't in terms of, I say underrepresented in terms of like how important I think it is for a lot of people. It's the way it's represented as well, because there's, you see all the flaws within the characters and within the friendship, and you kind of see the good, the bad and the ugly, and that just has an integrity and a reality to it that is what we want to watch, right?
It's interesting because it doesn't feel like the film's not judging them. Do you know what I mean? Like, it portrays their lifestyle, but it doesn't get you to draw kind of a moral judgment on them. There's no sort of punishment for them or any kind of judgment there. It's just these people, they are people, and kind of accept them for who they are. Was that something that kind of Sophie and Em were kind of keen be on sort of an underlying theme in this?
Yes. I think so. I think that was sort of unsaid, though. That's just like, what is...
what is the truth of?
Because if this were a studio movie, that would be a very different thing.
Yeah,
you know, like someone would have died. There would have been a horrible comeuppance.
Maybe back in 1954 or something. But yeah, I mean, you watch films back then, and if a woman kissed a man, she would die soon after. I think that's happening less and less. At least the punishment aspect of it. But I guess it's true. The gaze, there isn't a judgmental judgment on these characters, which is beautiful. But yeah, I think the inception of this idea that was birthed in Emma's, you know, brain, I don't think it ever started from a place like that, because it came from her own story.
Yeah.
And she is of the same, you know, ilk as these women. So we all kind of are, without knowing each other separately in the world and coming together, never judged these kinds of people.
What did you make of their friendship? I mean, was it supportive? Was it kind of toxic? Like, was it all of the above? Because it's very layered. It's very complex. But it's also, there's a slight disparity. There's manipulation. There's all sorts of aspects to it. Did you feel that it was a negative thing? Did you feel it was a positive thing? Or did you feel it wasn't, you know, that's quite reductive?
I think their friendship has probably been different things and all of the above. And different over the last decade.
Yeah, like really good friends
lives.
Are.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that we meet them at a time when maybe it's becoming not the best thing for them. And it, as much as they'll always be they'll always have heartstrings attached to each other, that it's maybe they need to go and explore something for themselves.
Because there's that underlying conversation, isn't it, about what, not just what your choices are, but what your choices are expected to be, like where you fit into the world, which I guess is something that tends to be forced on women in some ways, many much, much more than men. Like, you get to a point, it's like, if you're not thinking about, you know, whether it be getting married or having children or whatever it is, it's kind of exemplified in the film where there's the exchange of magazines, and it feels like the commodification of what women are supposed to be. Here's my bridal magazine. Here's my wedding magazine. Do you know what I mean? Where did you fall on that? Do you think that's something that's less an issue these days?
I think that depends in what kind of culture you surround yourself with. That's kind of easy for us to say, oh, hopefully not, but then in some places, absolutely.
Weirdly, some places we're finding in the world this kind of wave of like over conservatism. People are becoming more conservative now.
The more
modern it gets. It's a very strange reaction. You think the future is new, but both exist. I think someone asked us earlier, like, do you think you can be free and still have a kind of what's considered a more normal conservative, maybe female role, like getting married and having kids and giving up work? And for me personally, I don't define that as freedom, but of course you can be. And as Holiday said too, it's like a state of mind, like, to be free. But I guess that's the hope, is that everyone feels like there's more of a choice, and that we, whether you're male, female, or whatever, you don't define yourself based off of society, and you just are trying to do what you feel like your time has allotted you on this earth.
It's about curating your experiences based on your own desires.
Hey, there you go.
Very good. Very good.
Mic drop.
I'll be honest, I've not read the book, but it's written from Laura's point of view, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, sort of the thing. So we get a real understanding from, I gather, of what makes Laura tick in the book. But I guess Tyler's slightly more opaque. Like, you see her from Laura's perspective of who she is.
Yeah.
When you were digging into this, were you encouraged to kind of fill in the gaps yourself? Did you speak to Emma about it? Like, where did you form your image of who Tyler was?
Well, I had read the book not until I got to Dublin, and when we were doing rehearsals, because we were kind of going through the book and looking over quotes, and then I read it then for the first time. But I kind of wanted to make my own assessment of Tyler, because this might have been the only time, I did it another time, where I played a character that was written in a book before. And I didn't want it to feel like I was just grasping, or I wanted to just make my own assessment of her first and make her specific to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, when it comes to, you know, the book has a lot more details that aren't in the film about Tyler. So it was kind of a combination of me just wanting to create this, like, other being. And because it was in Laura's perspective, you know, it's like that famous, like, Fight Club thing. You're like, is she real? Like, we don't know. But it's like she has this kind of quality to her that's like she can be so many things, even though she's so flawed. So I just kind of wanted to keep that open, I guess.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Fight Club, because that was in my head, not just because her name's Tyler.
But
when I was watching this, because I think it was Kathleen Moran described this as kind of With Now for Girls, like that was her thing on it. I was like, this is Fight Club for women, you know, there's a whole subtext.
Wow, that's a big statement.
I was expecting this, like, at the end, she's not real, she's a projection of her mind, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, God, then that story really, you know, fucked it up for everybody. Everyone's like, is anyone real anymore in a movie? It's an easy escape.
Yeah.
You
do a particularly good rendition of Royals.
In
this film, was that written for you into the script, or did you get to choose it? Is that like your go-to karaoke number?
No, it was in the script, and not to brag, but I had to sing it double time, remember? In order for it to match the slow-mo.
Oh, really?
So I literally had to be like, we'll never be royals, we can be what we can be. I had to sing it like super fast.
And dance.
And dance at the same time.
Fast time. So double time singing, double time dancing.
In order for it to like match the slow-mo. So I was like, oh my God, if this sounds anywhere on key, I'm appreciative. But
that sounds like a karaoke nightmare. Tricky.
Yeah, it was a karaoke nightmare.
I have
nightmare.
To say, it was amazing to watch. Because when we listened
it was
to
tricky.
The, we got to sit and listen to the backing track and everyone was looking around going, oh my God, I mean, there's no fucking way I can do this. This is impossible. It's like, no one can sing that fast.
Yeah,
and then it was like, oh my God.
Yeah, it was like a little wind-up doll.
It was so amazing.
Yeah, but it was written and we were. I remember them being like, "We have to make sure we could get the rights and blah blah blah." Yeah. But we did, so we were very happy to, appreciative to Lord.
Are you? I mean, you've done lots and lots of singing. Is karaoke a thing? Is that one of your go-to social events?
You know, no, I'm not against it, but really? It's not my personal. Because I like singing, I take it a little too seriously. I think people who love karaoke are like. They like know all the songs, and to me, I'm like the loser who's like wants to pick a song I sound really good in, and I'm like, oh, that's not the scene, that's not the vibe.
Yeah, see, no one wants to do karaoke with someone who can sing.
Exactly. Yeah, nobody likes that person in the room. Yeah.
No, hold on, you're not a fan of singing, are you? I heard this. You've said this before. No, I'm judging your singing. Don't take that
my
the wrong way.
My awful singing voice has a reputation of its own.
No, I'm fairly certain you said once you auditioned for a musical, and in your own words, it was a car crash.
Oh my God, it was awful. I will never forgive everyone that made me audition for that. It wasn't actually that bad. I did come away with a note from the director saying, no, he was like, no, you can sing. You just can't like sing.
Yeah. You can like, sing, you just can't sing.
You can't like, he was just like, you just can't belt. He's like, you can sing.
You can
like,
sing, you just can't sing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you didn't have to do it double time, so I guess. Yeah.
Oh, I have, but he made me do high kicks and stuff on the stage.
Wow.
That's inappropriate.
Like improv'd. Oh,
what was the song? Or was it something from the specific
Danny
of the film?
Boy.
Jesus.
How do you do Danny Boy upbeat with high kicks? I mean.
Nobody. I mean, don't ask me.
Without high kicks, really, I think. I think I am out of time, guys. Thank you very much indeed.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
All right, so that was Holiday Grainger and Alia Shawkat, and we will be discussing that film, reviewing it, in fact, on next week's show, which is all very, very kind of exciting. But the film we will be discussing right now in the reviews section is The Current War.
Yes.
And why are people furious about raisins and sultanas?
No, The Current with an E.
Oh, okay. Yes.
They're furious about modern times. No, I'm kidding. This is set in olden days. And it is, of course...
don't get me started. The modern times, Ellen.
Oh, so this is the story of the rivalry between Thomas Edison, who is played here by Benedict Cumberbatch, and Michael Shannon's George Westinghouse. And the question was about creating a national grid for the US. So some people have described this film as being about the creation of the light bulb. The light bulb's already there. We already have the light bulb. That's safe. That's in the bag. Okay.
Good. Bus for home.
But the question is, who puts in the wires? And do they, and this is important, put in AC or DC currents?
Wait, this is an AC/DC biopic.
It's an AC/DC biopic.
So when does Angus Young come in?
Is Tony Stark
really
involved
late.
In this?
No,
just Doctor Strange and
just
Spider-Man.
Just Doctor Strange and Spider-Man, because Tom Holland plays Samuel Insull, who's the right-hand man to Thomas Edison. So the thing is, it is a really interesting rivalry potentially, but the problem is, how do you make that work on screen? Like, I fully believe that the book of this would be fascinating, but it's not maybe entirely fit for the screen. And so the director, who's Alfonso Gómez Rejón, basically resorts to a huge number of camera tricks and canted angles and weird sort of cuts and zooms and things. And you're just like, could you just take a breath, dude?
He's a guy who directed Me, Earl, and a Dying Girl, which I loved.
Mm. Right. Yeah, and I think the character work here and his work with the actors is exceptional, but I feel like he's continually trying to put pace into this story. He's continually trying to give it excitement. And the fact is, it's almost all people in a room talking. And there's only so much excitement you can put in. And they use their CG judiciously. They've built some beautiful sets. Mm-hmm. But it's just quite hard to make it visually appealing, I feel like. And you're really kind of, you know, dealing with the fact that the real history is not that cinematic. It is about two men who weren't quite inventors. Edison had, you know, obviously had invented, but he didn't quite invent this stuff. He's mostly just overseeing a workshop of people who are doing the hard work. He at one point hires Nikola Tesla, who's played by Nicholas Holt.
Well, Beast is in it as well.
Beast is in it as well. Unfortunately, that doesn't work out so well for him. You know, there's lots of interesting people coming in and out of the story. You've got J.P. Morgan, played by Matthew McFadyen. Great, great people. And yet not that exciting to watch.
How does Nicholas Holt's Tesla compare to David Bowie's Tesla in The Prestige?
He's in it for longer. Mm-hmm. He's almost as well-dressed, maybe even more spiffy, because he gets a few more outfit changes. But yeah, he has that same kind of air of sort of self-contained elegance about him. You've also got Catherine Waterston as Marguerite Westinghouse. Mm. So that's Michael Shannon's wife and very much confidant, and they have a nice relationship. Tuppence Middleton has a bit less to do as Mary Addison, sadly.
That's a shame. We should point out with this film, though, it was Weinstein'd. This is a movie that was coming out a couple of years ago.
2017, I think, originally, yeah.
And let's put it this way. It was, I don't think this was Alfonso Gomez-Rejon's initial vision. It was screened at the Toronto Film Festival, I think, or Venice, one of those two, back in 2017, and wasn't that well received, and then got shelled. It was meant to be maybe a contender for Oscars in 2018, and that clearly didn't happen, and then it got kind of stuck in limbo for a long, long time. And in fact, there's a really interesting story about this, that Gomez-Rejon managed to get the rights to the film back. He managed to get his own film back from Weinstein, from that morass, from the fallout of all that stuff. And had one day managed to get financing to do one day of reshoots and had eight different locations that he wanted to reshoot, and had only one location, a farmhouse. And so he and the cast and the crew worked really tirelessly to shoot eight additional new scenes in this one farmhouse, with each room representing a different place. So
fair play.
Yeah, and absolutely. And it feels like a bit of a shame, because I love Me and Earl and The Dying Girl, and I was really hoping for big things from this, and it just feels like a movie that's maybe never been given a chance to get off the ground.
I think that's probably fair. But I mean, as I say, this cast is so good that you would put up with a lot from them, frankly, and you don't need to. They're all on form. Yeah. And so I think that just about maybe keeps you interested, but it's a little bit, you know, disjointed, and it's got a mountain to climb in terms of keeping you interested in the question of electric wiring and dynamos. A lot of chat about dynamos. So anyway, we give this 3 stars.
3 stars. 3 stars, which we always say in the Empire podcast, is a recommendation. So maybe closer to DC than AC, maybe?
Yes, I don't know.
I don't know if that means anything, but yeah, 3 stars for The Current War. Just very, very quickly, there are a couple of films out this week, both of which we gave just 2 stars to, sadly. Horrible Histories, essentially Horrible Histories, a movie. Rotten Romans, which is the big screen version of the beloved CBBC show. Doesn't have any of the original classic cast in it, so no Simon Farnaby or Larry Rickard or Ben Wilbond or Martha Howe Douglas. I might as well mention the other two while we're here. Matt Bainton and Jim Havoc as well. They're not in this film. It's a new cast. But we gave this 2 stars. And I wonder if maybe kids and people who have families might still want to go see this, and it might be a bit of a blast. A little cheap and cheerful sketch comedy kind of thing. You know, Monty Python for kids. Mm. Maybe check it out. Who knows? And then there's the latest documentary from Nick Broomfield, the great documentarian. It's called Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love, and it's about the relationship between Marianne Illen and Leonard Cohen. And we gave that just 2 stars as well. So not great pickings at the old box office this week, but that may change next week with the re-release of Do the Right Thing and Hobbs and Shaw, or Fast and Furious Percent Hobbs and Shaw, or whatever the hell it's called. That'll be out next week as well. So do check that out. That is it for this week's Empire Podcast. We got through it without killing each other.
Hurrah!
Hey.
Fuck off, Ben.
Oh, why? Fuck honestly. You, Chris. What the fuck?
Why did you say hey in that tone of voice? How dare you?
I didn't
you?
Say hey at all, because I wouldn't say hey to you.
I will kill you.
Why don't you stay out of it?
Guys, let's go for some Sal's pizza and sort this whole thing out.
Okay. I'm fully on board. Fully on board. But only if I get to play Fight the Power on my massive boombox.
Okay.
Can I do that? All right. Good, good, good. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined, hopefully. We did say last week that Nick Frost would be here. That didn't happen, as you might have figured out by now.
Because he would have melted, because it was Nick Frost.
That is true. Frost in this heat does not work well at all. Neither does the guy who played Hercules on the small screen.
Kevin Sorbet. See, I jumped in and stole the punchline to that terrible joke.
You do that, don't you?
You do that.
Yeah.
I'm a
Yeah.
Punchline.
Bellend.
Bastard.
Bellend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Anyway, until next week, until we meet again, until a auspicious occasion, all that stuff, it is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
How dare you? It is goodbye from Ben Travis.
Bye.
Oh, nice, Ben. Oh, you can come back anytime.
Yeah,
it's goodbye from James Dyer.
Cock off.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to, well, frankly, guys, and thank you for not commenting on it, but I have been doing this podcast entirely nude, and I'm just going to put some clothes on.
Oh, thank God.
Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.